So we're reading from the Bhagavad Gita today. I've selected a couple of verses from the 8th chapter, Attaining the Supreme. And this is texts 5 and 6, which deal with the topic of death. So, and there's no need to be depressed about it. So, the first text 5, I'll chant the Sanskrit. Antakale chamameva smaran mukva kalevaram yaprayati samadbhavam yatinastyatra sangshaya. Text 6. Yam yang vapi smaran bhavam tyajatyante kalevaram tam tam evaiti kaunteya sadatad bhava bhavitaha. And the translations. And whoever, at the end of his life, quits his body remembering me alone, at once attains my nature. Of this there is no doubt. Whatever state of being one remembers when he quits his body, O son of Kunti, that state he will attain without fail. Om agyana timirandhasya gyananjana shalakaya chakshurun militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha. So the purports are very nice. So, in the first verse, the importance of Krishna consciousness is stressed, that anyone who quits his body in Krishna consciousness is at once transferred to the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord. The Supreme Lord is the purest of the pure. Therefore, anyone who is constantly Krishna conscious is also the purest of the pure. The word smaran, remembering, is important. Remembrance of Krishna is not possible for the impure soul who has not practiced Krishna consciousness in devotional service. Therefore, one should practice Krishna consciousness from the very beginning of life. If one wants to achieve success at the end of his life, the process of remembering Krishna is essential. Therefore, one should constantly, incessantly chant the Maha Mantra, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Lord Chaitanya has also advised that one should be as tolerant as a tree, Taror Iva Sahishnuna. There may be so many impediments for a person who is chanting Hare Krishna. Nonetheless, tolerating all these impediments, one should continue to chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, so that at the end of one's life, one can have the full benefit of Krishna consciousness. And in the second purport, begins here, the process of changing one's nature at the critical moment of death is here explained. A person who at the end of his life quits his body thinking of Krishna attains the transcendental nature of the Supreme Lord. But it is not true that a person who thinks of something other than Krishna attains the same transcendental state. This is a point we should note carefully. How can one die in the proper state of mind? Maharaj Bharat, although a great personality, thought of a deer at the end of his life. So in his next life, he was transferred into the body of a deer. Although as a deer, he remembered his past activities, he had to accept an animal body. Of course, one's thoughts during the course of one's life accumulate to influence one's thoughts at the moment of death. So this life creates one's next life. If in one's present life one lives in the mode of goodness and always thinks of Krishna, it is possible for one to remember Krishna at the end of one's life. That will help one be transferred to the transcendental nature of Krishna. If one is transcendentally absorbed in Krishna's service, then his next body will be transcendental, spiritual, not material. Therefore, the chanting of Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, is the best process for successfully changing one's state of being at the end of one's life. So it's a very key point here, because death, as we know, is inevitable for everyone. And it is actually stated in the Mahabharata how Maharaj Yudhishthira commented that the most amazing and wonderful thing in this world is that although everyone's forefathers have died, one's parents, grandparents, and so many friends and relatives have died, one never actually believes that one is going to die oneself. Somehow, that intimation of immortality is something that is a truly intrinsic part of life. We really don't believe we're going to die, and the fact is we really don't die. And so it is a conundrum, but definitely, of course, we know that the body dies. And so there are so many religions in the world, there are so many philosophies in the world, and all of them ultimately have to deal with this question. What happens after death? And we can see that Christianity, Islam, they have the ideas of heaven and hell that are, you know, fairly standard. And then the Buddhists, their idea is that their ideas of reincarnation, you're reborn according to your karma until you attain nirvana, which is a state that is not exactly explained in their philosophy, not exactly it's not exactly clear what that nirvana amounts to, or one attains the Buddha, one attains becoming the Buddha oneself, a Buddha, in other words, and one sees how, for example, in the Tibetan Buddhist religion, the various lamas, they're reborn and reborn and reborn, and they're sought after. When the Dalai Lama dies, then there's a search for who is his next incarnation, where is he from, and so that idea is there in Buddhism, and then we have the atheists and agnostics, by and large, who believe that once the body dies, it's finished. There is no longer any consciousness. That is their attempt at Buddhist philosophy, you might say, that they are entering the void once they die. So these are the common beliefs. And belief, of course, is not a substitute for reality. So the problem is, of course, that in the modern world, the scientific revolution has created this idea that unless one can prove something scientifically, it has no relevance, and in that, if it has no relevance, it has no existence. That's their philosophy. And so, because a life after death cannot be proven, therefore, it is dismissed as unimportant. However, there is a flaw in that philosophy. And the flaw is that if we take human existence and human life and we examine it, we can see, for example, that one has a mind, or one has an intelligence, but one cannot actually display that intelligence or that mind in its subtle form. We can only derive the idea that someone has intelligence and a mind by their activities, their speech, their action, and so on. So to simply say that because we cannot with scientific instruments prove that something is not there, that it has no reality. We know intelligence has a reality. We know the mind has a reality. Because we are human, because we are conscious. And so it is that element of consciousness that we understand from the Bhagavad Gita is what propels one from one life to the next. There's a beautiful verse in the 9th chapter where it describes how that the bodies that one takes up in this life can be compared to the various fragrances that are absorbed by the wind as it passes through the world. Beautiful metaphor for how the spiritual entity moves from one body to another. And in the 2nd chapter of Bhagavad Gita, it explains how after a body becomes old and worn out, it is discarded by the vehicle of what we call death. The body is discarded, and a new body is provided for that consciousness. So these are basic elements of Bhagavad Gita, and so in that sense, we get another chance. And our understanding of death is also based on the analysis of life. What constitutes life? What constitutes a living entity? What makes an entity living? And for this reason, Srila Prabhupada had the book printed, Life Comes from Life, because we can see that whatever kind of living entity, whether it's people, animals, birds, aquatics, insects, everything is coming from either from eggs or seeds or cell reproduction. These living entities are all generated from another living entity. We never see that something is coming from nothing. Even in the material, even the material elements, we understand that no atoms are just appearing out of nothing. Atoms are constantly being transformed from one form of energy to another, whether it's heat, light, whether it's the actual substance of the elements, these things, hydrogen, oxygen, and so on, gases, these things are all being generated. These are not actually being generated, they're being transformed by the material energy. So this is a key understanding, and I know in my childhood there was always the big puzzle given, what came first, chicken or the egg, you know? And so it's, you can't explain that any other way than that there has to be some original generator of all this life, of all this activity, of all these planets, of all these stars, of all this thing. And Srila Prabhupada actually was very pleased when one of the devotees in Sri Lanka, he actually got into a big debate with an atheist, and the debate was published in the newspapers of Sri Lanka, and it was an ongoing thing between the two of them. The atheist would write one article, and then our devotee would write a counter article. And Srila Prabhupada loved this actual interchange between argument with, and in the end the devotee won, because the challenge was there. I'll give you any amount of chemicals if you can produce an egg that will hatch into a chicken. That was actually the challenge. And obviously the atheist, they couldn't match the challenge. They could not, in fact, do what they said they could. So this first principle, that the soul has an existence apart from the body, it's very crucial. And yet we don't accept it very easily, or people in general don't accept it very easily. But apart from this, the Bhagavad Gita has so much more than this simple thing, this simple understanding of the difference between the soul and the body. And there are the five basic questions that have to be asked, that have to be answered by a philosophy or a religion or whatever kind of theory that one can put forward. And the five basic questions, well, we've answered the first one, is what is the living entity? So then, but the living entity doesn't exist in a vacuum. We're not living on some, you know, in outer space floating around. We have a whole thing happening here. We have mountains, we have oceans, we have deserts, you know, so many things, physical manifestations, stars, planets, moons, you know, deserts, volcanoes, forests, you know, all these different realities are there of environment that we're living in. So what is the nature? Where does this come from? And also, these things, especially if you look at the orbit of the Earth, Earth is revolving around the Sun, and if we know that if the Earth was just a little bit too close to the Sun, we'd all burn up and die, there'd be no life on the planet, or if it was just a little bit further away from the Sun, we'd all freeze to death, and there'd be no life on the planet either. So some things, there's some kind of controller that's keeping this Earth doing what it does best, which is maintaining life and propagating and allowing a human existence. And so the Bhagavad Gita explains that there is a controller, that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, through his various potencies, controls the universe and controls the living entities and controls even all the material energies within this world. So, for example, in the 15th chapter, it is called a Purushottama Yoga chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Purushottama refers to the ultimate or supreme person. So the supreme person is the person in control, actually, of all these things. And we understand through the agency of the Param Atma. Atma means soul, and Param means supreme. So the agency of the Param Atma enters not only within the heart of every living being, not only in within and acts as the witness, but also enters into every atom. This is an inconceivable potency. We cannot imagine, even with our brain, how it is that something can enter into the atom. We can understand that the atom is split and there's a huge explosion. We can understand so many things about this material world. But an agent that actually enters into every atom of being in this universe, that is an inconceivable concept. But that is the proposition of the Bhagavad Gita. This is what the Bhagavad Gita tells us, is the reality of what is keeping this material universe in place, in sync, moving along. And so, apart from the controller, the living entity, the material energy, there are two other factors that the Bhagavad Gita handles. And one of those is the aspect of time. Time is the most mysterious element of this universe. It is an inescapable element. It is not that you can't turn time back, you can't fast forward, much as we'd like to, much as we'd want to. We can't. It is just there. It is an omnipresent reality. Time. Time means things have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Time is the tapestry, is the background for the next thing that the Bhagavad Gita explains, which is action. In order for there to be action, there has to be time in which that action can take place. That is inescapable. That is reality. We can see it. Any person with any intelligence can understand that. So what is this element of time? And also, what are the regarding action, What are the various mechanisms that control action? How does action work? And action, according to the Bhagavad Gita, works on two levels. First, there's the physical level, where you have actions and reactions. You know, the gun goes off, the bullet goes one way, and the kickback goes the other way, that kind of thing. It's a very simple thing, action and reaction. But there is a further element of action, which is called enjoyment and suffering. How that action is perceived by the living entity. And the laws of action are very intricate. We don't know actually the extent of these actions. And for action to take action to have an eternal component, you might say, or an ongoing component, we have to understand the initial proposition of the Bhagavad Gita that the living entity is passing through different bodies, acquiring certain actions, performing certain actions, and suffering and enjoying the reactions of these life after life. That is an eternal cycle that is going on. And so this roughly is the understanding of the Bhagavad Gita. And now that we've named the five elements, we can see that we can start to understand what is the driving force behind this material world. And it's described in the scriptures that this driving force is desire. Desire is the driving force for every living entity. And it is through desire that civilizations come and go. It is through desire that people act as they do. It is the driving force. So we have to examine the various actions, the various desires that we have in our hearts. And that is the point of the first of the verses here that are describing what happens at the time of death. That what happens at the time of death depends on our desires in this life. If we aspire to material things, material conditions, if we look for material conditions, then in our next life we will attain material conditions. And we may have to perform austerities to actually realize those things. Just as if austerity is a simple matter of understanding. If I want to be a doctor, I have to go to college. I have to get the degree. I have to pass the examinations. I'm not just going to be a doctor just because I want to be. I have to perform the austerities, and I have to have the intelligence, and I have to have so many qualifications to get where I want to go to. And so the whole essence of Krishna consciousness is to somehow train those desires to the proper place. So described in the Vedic literature that there are four fields of action, four types of activity that the human being engages in. There's dharma, which is religion. People engage in religion for certain reasons, for certain desires, because they want something from God, or at least in the case of devotees, we understand because they want to serve God. Then there is artha. Artha means economic development. That's fairly easy to understand in this day and age, that people are simply scrambling after money in whatever way they can. Kama, which is sense gratification, is the third activity of human life, of human material life. And finally, moksha, or liberation. Liberation is described as a material desire. People want to be free. You know, that's the Constitution of the United States. It's for people to be free, to have liberty. You know, to be able to do whatever they want to do. But moksha, in the Vedic sense, means to be free of material desire. So in that sense, it is the most important. But for the devotee, this is not enough. For the devotee, the real essence of life is, instead of serving one's own senses, one's own desires, to serve the senses and serve the desires of the Supreme Person, to serve the desires of Krishna. And finding that out requires one to actually find someone, find a spiritual master who has those qualities of service to Krishna and service to the senses of Krishna. It's a very important aspect. And without it, because, as is described, one is born in the darkness of knowledge. One is born in the darkness of ignorance. And the spiritual master enlightens one with a torchlight of knowledge. Before Srila Prabhupada's coming to the West, basically this knowledge was completely unknown in Western countries. It is absolutely that Srila Prabhupada has come and given this freely, given this important legacy of India to the rest of the world. And and this is because he was completely surrendered to his spiritual master. And his spiritual master, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, was surrendered completely to his spiritual master, and on in that chain of disciplic succession called parampara, to Krishna, leading to Krishna himself. And Krishna accepts that service to the Guru, and that and enlightens the disciple who questions the Guru, and to receive those answers of spiritual knowledge. And so Srila Prabhupada is given a very simple formula, as we can see from the purports described, that the chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is really the key to coming to know Krishna and to becoming in line with Krishna's desires. It's what actually allows us to have some access in that way. And that is a famous shloka in Bhagavad Gita 4:34, that simply approach a spiritual master, inquire from him submissively, and render service unto him, that the great souls, they can impart knowledge unto you because they've seen the truth. Is actually to be a knower, a seer of the truth. And this is a saying in Sanskrit, Shastra Chakshus. Shastra means the scriptures, and Chakshus means vision, to have the vision of the Shastra, that one sees through that prism, that focus that the scriptures give us. And that, through the instruction of the spiritual master, through his ability to enlighten us and his ability to touch us and actually point us in the right direction, that is the goal of this human form of life. Human form of life should never be underestimated. It is the most dear form of life to Krishna himself. And those, especially those who adopt the path of yoga, who adopt the path of bhakti yoga, are even more especially dear to Krishna. So this is our focus in the Krishna consciousness movement. Focus on the chanting, focus on sadhana, focus on all the rules, not just the rules and regulations, but also focus on the philosophy. And in that way, actually, at the time of death, to come to that realization that propels us towards Krishna himself. So there's a few minutes left. Does anyone have any questions? Or yes? There's a microphone coming.
Prabhu, you were speaking about time, and yes. We have the cycles of the different yugas, mm-hmm. and they have their time periods in terms of the earth. So I'm just curious, in terms of the yuga cycles mm-hmm. on the higher planetary systems, do you know anything about that in terms of their existence and their time frames and their manifestations?
The time frames are... This reference in time is that this universe goes through different cycles that are called yugas, and there are four yugas make up what's called a kalpa. And this, so the yugas, Kali Yuga, which is the yuga we live in now, is 432,000 years. The previous yuga, which Kali Yuga is the Iron Age, the previous yuga was the Copper Age, or Bronze Age, and this is double that amount, 860,000 years. Before that is the Silver Age, the Dwapara Treta Yuga, which is double that, which is 1,600,000 years, and then beyond that is the Satya Yuga, the first Yuga, which is the Golden Age, which is double that, which is 3,200,000, something like that. It doubles down rather than up, but anyway, just for my mathematical mathematically challenged brain, this is the cycle. And we understand that there are minor and major devastations at the beginning of the various cycles, and so in this way we can see scientifically. Actually, it's an interesting factor, this whole time factor, that there used to be a program on science. There was this scientist whose name was Carl Sagan, and he had this whole series of examining the universe from the scientific viewpoint, and as a scientist, he said, actually, the only human computation of the ages that kind of matched what the scientists actually believe was the Vedic, this series of cycles, that this was the only one that approximated, to some degree, the scientific understanding of how old the various geological strata are on this planet. So that's a very interesting point on while we're dealing with the aspect of time. Yes.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the Earth planet, these are the years. But I'm wondering if they're corresponding to other planets as well, and to higher levels in the universe. Do they have the yugic cycles, and are they manifested in a similar way, similar time period? Or is there a difference? I'm just wondering if you've heard anything about that.
The difference is not so much for the time cycles. The difference is for the living entities that take birth on these planets. That is the understanding, I think, from my reading of it, is that the demigods have 10,000-year lifespans, that different... higher planets have different time frames, and in the final, when the universe is wound up, and the universe finally is destroyed, and through the breathing of the Mahavishnu, which is another whole other beyond comprehension kind of experience, I would think, that at that time, Lord Brahma's, in some cycles, Lord Brahma and his planet, they remain, and all the other planets get destroyed, and then the universe is recreated, and finally, at the end of Lord Brahma's lifespan, then Lord Brahma actually dies, and the entire universe is finished. And then from the breathing of Mahavishnu, the planets are expanded again outwardly, and the planets are recreated according to the karma of the people. When the universe is destroyed, people who are still within this material energy, they have certain desires. These desires are then kept in a dormant state, and when the universe is recreated, then these living entities, they take birth according to their karma in the next universe that's created, and so on. So this is a fairly esoteric kind of part of examination of time and the various time things. Yes. So there are multiple universes, and from the description that the breathing of Mahavishnu generates all the planets, all the universes, it would seem that the universes simultaneously they're all created, and then simultaneously they're all destroyed, all within the breathing of Mahavishnu. So Mahavishnu's lifespan, of course, is, well, we understand that these are eternal Vishnu Tattva entities. They are eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss, and from them all potencies arise. That is the nature of Godhead. And so there's one important point here, that's the nature of Godhead, but we understand that there is also the personality of Godhead, that Krishna has his own abode within the spiritual world, and Krishna's personality is very unique, he is a very particular person, and just as each and every one of us is a particular person, yet we are part and parcel of Krishna, and he is very great and we are very small. So, well, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.